200th day. A senior Hamas military official says that Israel is stuck in a quagmire in Gaza and will reap nothing but shame and defeat. And Lebanon's Hezbollah movement launches its deepest drone strike into Israel in months as Palestinian fighters carry out a missile attack on two Israeli settlements. This is World News. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, 200 days into the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, and the regime has intensified attacks all across the devastated territory, killing more innocent women and children. In the north, fresh strikes pounded Jabalia and Beit Hanun in the heaviest shelling in weeks. Israel has ordered new evacuations in Beit Lahia, describing it as a dangerous combat zone. Non-stop shelling and airstrikes were also reported in central Gaza. Elsewhere, fresh shelling hit the east of the southern city of Khan Yunis. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 32 people were killed and 59 injured in the past day, bringing the death toll to nearly 32,200. Months of relentless onslaught has flattened large swathes of besieged territory and displaced almost all of its 2.3 million population. Now, from Deir al-Bala, let's bring in our correspondent, Mati Abu Musabe, is there and reporting all those developments there. Mati, day 200, and we see escalation on both sides.
Yes, Behrouz. First of all, let me begin with the latest press release of the Al-Qassam, the spokesperson of the Al-Qassam Brigades, whereas he stated that 200 days after this genocidal war began on Gaza Strip and the Israeli occupation forces are still stuck in Gaza Strip. And he asserted that the Palestinian resistance is able to fight back against the Israeli occupation forces and the Palestinian resistance is resilient enough to face and to fight back against the Israeli occupation forces on the ground. And in the meantime, he saluted the Iranian retaliatory attack against the Israeli occupation forces that took place over the last couple of weeks. On the ground here, we can say that the Israeli occupation forces are still intensifying their attacks against several parts of Gaza Strip. Whereas here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained against the eastern part of Al-Burij refugee camp. In the meantime, the Israeli warplanes actually carried out several belts of fire against the same area, the eastern part of Al-Burij refugee camp. While when it comes to the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, it is still subjected to fierce and drastic attacks of the Israeli warplanes and the Israeli artillery shelling. As you know that, those continuous and repetitive attacks actually left hundreds of the Palestinian residential buildings completely destroyed on the ground. While when it comes to Khan Yunis city, the number and the toll of the Palestinian corpses extracted from the mass graves in the Nasser Medical Complex actually has risen to roughly 310 Palestinian dead bodies. And according to the estimates of the Gaza civil defense crews, that hundreds of the Palestinian civilians are still missing and trapped under the rubble and buried in such mass graves inside the city. While when it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, the current situation is still hyper-hazardous as the Israeli occupation forces actually vow to re-attack the Beit Hanun, Beit Lahia city. As you know that they are demanding thousands of the Palestinian civilians to evacuate the entire city of Beit Lahia. They are claiming that they need to engage in fierce clashes and attacks against the Palestinian resistance there, particularly after the Palestinian resistance actually managed to launch several barrages of the Palestinian rockets into the Israeli occupied territories. The Israeli occupation forces are still facing fierce resistance inside those areas despite the massive destruction they have inflicted in those areas, particularly Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia and Jabalia city. In the meantime, the Israeli warplanes actually maintained and resumed their airstrikes against those areas amid heavy and continuous and chronic actually artillery shelling that ignited big fires and blazes against those areas. So it is notable and palpable that the Israeli occupation forces actually have risen the ferocity of their attacks against all areas of Gaza Strip. And even, as you know, that when it comes to Rafah City, the Israeli occupation forces are still vowing and threatening to conduct their ground offensive against the Rafah City, raising the concerns among the people there that they would face even more catastrophic and dreadful humanitarian conditions. And as you know, that the Palestinians there have no place to go amid these unprecedented situations and conditions that they have facing. They are facing these moments. So the current situation is escalating every moment here in all areas of Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation forces are still attacking all areas of Gaza Strip. And the current situation in terms of the humanitarian conditions is still exacerbating and aggravating every moment.
Yeah, we just, speaking of humanitarian situation, Mutia, I was just going to ask you about it, about the situation on food and fuel reaching there, because UNRWA defended itself regarding all the false Israeli claims regarding UNRWA, and it is saying that Israeli forces do not allow humanitarian convoys to go in.
Yes, actually, as I've mentioned, that at the same time, the Israeli occupation forces intensify their attacks against all areas of Gaza Strip. On the ground, they are still stalling and procrastinating the flow of those humanitarian supplies into all areas of Gaza Strip. According to the director of the emergency committee in Rafah City, he stated that the current situation in Rafah is catastrophic by all means. The Palestinian people there are still suffering from the severe shortage of the basic necessities, the life necessities, as you know, in terms of the food, the medicine, the drinkable water. The Palestinian people actually feel that they are going to face actually a real catastrophe after roughly 7 consecutive months of this suffering that they have been experiencing all the time. If the Israeli occupation forces are going to conduct their ground offensive against Rafah City, the Palestinian people will be facing a real catastrophe by all means, because as you know, that the current situation on the ground is completely catastrophic and beyond catastrophic, and this is expected and is due to become more catastrophic, as the Israeli occupation forces are still using starvation and the deprivation of the Palestinian people in terms of those humanitarian necessities as a weapon of war in order to put more pressure on the Palestinian civilians on the ground and to twist the arm of the Palestinian resistance.
Okay, appreciate that coverage. Mutia Abu Musabeh, our correspondent in Deir al-Balah, Gaza City. Now, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights says that he is horrified by the destruction of the Nasser and al-Shifa hospitals in Gaza and the discovery of mass graves there. Volker Turk said that some of the bodies had their hands tied. That indicates serious violations of human rights law and international humanitarian law. He also called for further investigations. Last week, the discovery of a mass grave at Nasser Hospital drew global condemnations. Bodies were also discovered at Al-Shifa following an Israeli raid on the site. The bodies were reportedly buried beneath piles of waste and included women and the elderly. Mr. Lazzarini, the UNRWA chief, speaking there at a presser of the United Nations, has said that Israel has not provided any evidence to support its anti-UNRWA allegations. That UNRWA staff, they're saying that UNRWA staff participated and had a role in the October 7th operation by Hamas and that sort of allegations. And the UN agency actually lost around 180 of its staff members while delivering aid and doing humanitarian work in Gaza. And because of the Israeli allegations, several Western countries cut funding to UNRWA. And Mr. Lazzarini just said in only 48 hours, there were several 16 or 18, if I heard him right, countries stopped funding UNRWA, and which means a lot of loss for the Palestinians in terms of aid delivery. And that fortunately some of them are back, and they're waiting for a report soon so that hopefully the other donors would also go back and continue funding UNRWA to be able to do its job. He also regretted that that was not going to be a permanent UN body. It was going to be doing a temporary job, but for 75 years it's been doing this job and has had this mandate because of the continued occupation of the Palestinian land. That was just what he had to say in that briefing. Now, moving on with our news, the spokesman of Hamas's military wing says that the Israeli regime has achieved nothing but killings and destruction in its 200 days of onslaught on Gaza. In a video statement, Abu Ubaida said that the Israeli enemy is in a quagmire stuck in the sands of Gaza. He said that the regime is still trying to restore its image in Gaza, but it will reap nothing but shame and defeat. The spokesman added that the resistance in Gaza is as solid as the mountains of Palestine. Abu Ubaida vowed that the Palestinian resistance will continue with its strikes as long as the aggression against Palestine continues. He also hailed Iran's recent punitive operation against Israel, saying that a massive attack established new rules and disrupted the regime's calculations. From Belfast, I'm now joined by Saab Shah, an author and West Asia expert. Good to have you with us, Saab. So 200 days passed. Tell us what the Israeli regime has achieved in Gaza.
This is from time to time we hear the Israeli media comes out with the news reports, confirms that the resistance actually have not been defeated. That's their own media. And in the same media comes and confirm that their entity shows us disperse, the dispersed experience by the Zionist entity and its colonial settlers on the ground. And that due to the failure of their invading force, that invading force, the number of it is huge. It was 360,000 reservists on top of 200,000 professional soldiers. So this is 560,000 army of professional and reservists armed with the state-of-the-art killing machines supplied by 70% by the Americans and 30% by the Germans to fight nearly a few thousand freedom fighters in the Gaza Strip. As Abu Ubaida said, the only thing they manage is the genocide against the indefensible civilians and the destruction of the whole cities and towns, as we witness what's coming out of Khan Yunis Nasser Hospital, the bodies being exhumed with over 300 and maybe 20 till now. And these bodies, as reports by the doctors in there, they said they've been skinned. They took the skin off and the even organs from the corpses. And I don't know what sick armies ever did such a thing. Even the Nazis did do such a thing. The same thing they experienced, the people in Shifa Hospital in Gaza. So this whole armada of West and the Zionist entity occupation failed to impose their will on the people of Gaza and failed to achieve any goal they declared, not to even release one prisoner by force. The only prisoners took place was negotiated and agreed upon. By force, they managed to achieve zero. And still now, they are bogged down in the moving sands of Gaza. And the resistance is controlling its territories on the ground. And that's why we can see from now to, from time to time, the Zionist entity's army visiting areas again with massive assault, which they said they purged the resistance from there. They destroyed the resistance brigades in there. And suddenly they are back in. You can see that in Gaza. You can see that in the middle area of Bridge and Deir el-Balah and Nusirat. You can see that in Khan Yunis as well. So whatever they have achieved in 200 days, nothing except destruction and killing and genocide.
All right, thank you so much. Saab Shah, author and West Asia expert in Belfast. Now, Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says it's launched drone attacks into two Israeli bases in retaliation for the regime's assassination of one of its fighters early in the day. The movement said it's launched a combined air attack using decoy and explosive drones that targeted two Israeli bases north of the occupied Palestinian city of Aqqa. This is Hezbollah's deepest attack into the Israeli-occupied territory since the Gaza war began, and that after an Israeli air raid hit a vehicle on a highway in southern Lebanon, killing a Hezbollah member. The Lebanese resistance movement and the Israeli military have been trading fire since October the 8th, a day after Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza. Protests at Columbia University have forced authorities to cancel in-person classes. In the Northeast, dozens of protesters were arrested at Yale University. In Massachusetts, gates to Harvard Yard were closed to public in an attempt to head off protests. Students have also set up tents and held rallies and sit-ins at other U.S. campuses across the nation. They demand that universities divest finances from manufacturers that sell weapons to Israel. A call to grow one for the U.K. to scrap a controversial plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, as the British government says it will go ahead with the previously announced timelines. The United Nations says the move threatens the rule of law and will set a perilous precedent globally. It also calls on the British government to take practical measures based on international cooperation and respect for international human rights law. Now, Europe's highest rights body also joined the calls. It says the plan raises concerns about the human rights of asylum seekers. The British Parliament, in a heated debate on Monday, passed a bill under which asylum seekers would be deported to Rwanda to await a decision on their applications. That's a wrap for now. Thank you for being with us.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States' involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq war diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. Were these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers? Or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military? Its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment. What lessons should my generation of Americans, and those that come after us, draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home? In November 2010, the U.S. Army charged five soldiers from its 5th Stryker Brigade with the killing and mutilation of several Afghan civilians for sport. The soldiers, who called themselves the Kill Team, included Private First Class Andrew Holmes, who was 19 years old at the time of the killings, and Corporal Jeremy Morlock, who was 22.
As a defense attorney, I'm representing my clients, but I'm also a part of a broader search for truth. And I, too, am interested in the truth, and I'm interested in justice. And sometimes our job as defense attorneys is to ensure that justice is served. And by that I mean that justice is not excessive.
Daniel Conway is a former Marine staff sergeant and a military defense lawyer. Conway has defended numerous soldiers accused of misconduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, including those charged in the Haditha massacre.
PFC Holmes was required to set up security on top of a hill. Now, his team leader, Corporal Morlock, ran to the bottom of the hill and decided, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, that on January 15th, 2010, PFC Holmes did not know what Corporal Morlock was about to do.
Conway represented Private Andrew Holmes in the Stryker 5 case. As the Stryker 5 soldiers faced court-martial proceedings in 2011, Der Spiegel and Rolling Stone published gruesome pictures of the soldiers posing with the bodies of murdered Afghans. On January 15, 2010, Corporal Morlock and the so-called Kill Team murdered the first of three Afghan civilians. For months, they had been planning to kill innocent Afghans using unaccounted-for grenades.
Corporal Morlock, he took this as a target of opportunity. And Corporal Morlock was at the bottom of a hill, about 110 feet away from PFC Holmes, who was facing the opposite direction. Corporal Morlock spotted two farmers, young Afghan farmers in a field, and motioned for one of them to come over to him like this. He called the man over.
As the farmer approached, Corporal Morlock called for Private Holmes to join him at the bottom of the hill. Holmes was unaware that Morlock was about to act on his plans to kill.
When the man got to approximately 20 feet from Corporal Morlock called for PFC Holmes, who was on top of a hill. Holmes repositioned. Now at that time, PFC Holmes started running down the hill with his squad automatic machine gun and his goggles on. It was hot that morning. Started running down the hill. Corporal Morlock was already behind about a 3-foot high wall. The man was 20 feet away from Corporal Morlock. Corporal Morlock was going through what they call standard escalation of force procedures to ensure that the man didn't have any weapons. So he told the man in the local dialect to lift his shirt to demonstrate that there was no suicide vest. And he told him to turn around.
The man complied with Morlock's orders, clearly showing that he carried no weapons or explosives. Meanwhile, Holmes continued down the hill, stopping to take a drink and catch his breath.
About that time, PFC Holmes was getting down to the bottom of the hill behind the wall. He was out of breath. He was breathing hard. And he kneeled down to take a sip of water. Now, at that time, Corporal Morlock, again, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, tossed a grenade over the wall. The grenade didn't go very far. Went probably 5 or 6 feet.
Morlock had told his fellow soldiers of plans to murder civilians and frame their killings as self-defense. But until that day, Holmes had not taken Corporal Morlock seriously.
Corporal Morlock's plan, and they had talked about this, PFC Holmes never thought Corporal Morlock was serious about it because it's a psychotic plan. So PFC Holmes never took him seriously. Corporal Morlock drops the grenade over the wall and screams for PFC Holmes to shoot. PFC Holmes stands up, places his squad automatic weapon on the wall, and it lets out about a 5 to 6 round burst, which with a machine gun is an instant. Now, whether the rounds actually hit the man or not, we aren't exactly sure. PFC Holmes believed they did. Forensic evidence was inconclusive on the matter. We had probably one of the leading forensic pathologists in the world, Dr. Michael Bodden, and Dr. Bodden was unable to identify any wounds in the photos of the man that were consistent with machine gun fire.
Forensic experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, "Holmes, get down," and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade, which, of course, we believed killed the man.
The Striker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Striker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He went opened one tent. He threw. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, 2 or 3 times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq. And The decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not, he was not capable, he was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD, and it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. You know, we've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, I mean, sickening. I mean, that's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical. Some critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds, or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo, and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image: American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts, and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, "The gentlemen, the gloves are coming off," along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as "the gloves are coming off" suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response that said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out: there will be no abuse in my command, and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was, the message sort of was, well, we don't torture. However, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq. It went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is, how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior? The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception, but just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq, in their time coming home, that would lead to this? When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there, and they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, if these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq. So let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I gotta tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
وضمنت لهم الإجابة فإليك يا رب نصبت وجهي وإليك يا رب مددت يدي فبعزتك استجب لي دعائي
Brothers and sisters, We were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail Supplication. فَإِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّ نَصَبْتُ وَجْهِي وَإِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّ مَدَدْتُ يَدِي. So towards you, my Lord, I have turned my face, and towards you, my Lord, I have extended my hand. فَبِعِزَّتِكَ اسْتَجِبْ لِي دُعَائِي وَبَلِّغْنِي مُنَائِي. So by your might, comply with my supplication, and make me attain my desires. وَلَا تَقْتَعْ مِنْ فَضْلِكَ رَجَاعِي. Do not, if it pleases you, sever my hopes. وَكْفِنِي شَرَّ الْجِنِّ وَالْإِنْسِ مِنْ أَعْدَائِي. And spare me the evil of my enemies from among the jinn and men. Regarding this part of the Kumail supplication, dear listeners, we discussed the different aspects of the forgiveness and the vast ocean of mercy of the Almighty Allah. Among these, it has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, from his father and from his grandfather, that people of Kufa came to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, complaining for a lack of rain and famine. They asked him, call upon Allah to send us rain. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam told Imam Hussein, ask Allah for rain. Imam Hussein alayhi salam praised Allah. And we know that this is one of the prerequisites of the acceptance of supplication. So at first he praised Allah and his messenger, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and called upon Allah. He said, O the bestower of the blessings and the descender of rain, send bountiful rain for us to save your servants from inability and revive dead lands. Amen, O Lord of the worlds. And when his prayer finished, it rained heavily. An Arab came from another region of Kufa and said, I saw so much water in hills and valleys that it was as if the water waved. We ask the Almighty Allah to satisfy the thirst of our people today as well. He is the one who satisfied the thirst of the people of Kufa with the prayer of one of his sincere servants. We have to return, we have to resort to these sincere, truthful servants of the Almighty Allah and ask them to ask from the Almighty Allah for his mercy, to clear our sins from our books of deeds, to save us from the chastisements of our sins, to grow the plant of joyful worship in us. We must ask them. And surely we have come to the Almighty Allah with our hope of His mercy. And we know that He would certainly forgive us.
Verily, you have ordained for your servants your worship and bidden them to supplicate unto you and have assured them of your response. So, my Lord, I look earnestly towards you, and towards you, my Lord, I have stretched forth my hands. Therefore, by your honor, respond to my prayers and let me attain my wishes. And by your bounty, frustrate not my hopes and protect me from the evils of my enemies, from among the jinns and mankind.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
About hope of mercy, there is also another tradition narrated. Once a young man was passing an alley when he saw a bird on a tree branch. He shot an arrow towards it, but it hit the son of the garden's owner and killed him. So, some innocent passersby were arrested from around the garden for that crime. The young man came to the garden and asked, "What's the matter?" He was answered, "Someone has shot this boy with an arrow." The young man said, "Bring me the arrow so that I may tell you." Then he said, "I threw this arrow for hunting, but it has hit this boy. I am the murderer." The boy's father said, "I know you did it accidentally, young man, but why did you confess to your fault?" The young man answered, "In hope of your mercy, so that you would forgive me because of my confession." So the father forgave him. We must ask the generous of the generous. We have confessed in this divine Kumail supplication to all our sins, that he would forgive us by his indefinite mercy. So that's why we ask him and say, فَإِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّي نَصَبْتُ وَجْهِي وَإِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّي مَدَدْتُ يَدِي. Oh Lord, towards you I have turned my face, towards you I have extended my hand. I have recognized this, that I have no one else to turn to, and that's why I have come to you. إِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّي نَصَبْتُ وَجْهِي. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya don't let me go astray, 'cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Steps up deadly strikes on the besieged Gaza Strip. The genocidal onslaught against the Palestinians entering its 200th day.